This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Yesterday, the Vermont Senate debated and then finally approved a bill that would regulate the legal sale and possession of recreational marijuana. It was a close vote, 16 in favor, 13 against. Now the bill will go to the House, where it still faces staunch opposition. In yesterday's two-hour floor debate, Senate President Pro Tem John Campbell spoke against legalizing pot. He said it's disturbing to him that the vote comes as Vermont tries to counter the effects of what he called an epidemic of opiate abuse.
And what's our answer? Let's legalize another substance, another drug. I think that is a terrible, terrible message to send to our kids, to our friends, our neighbors.
On the pro side, Senate Minority Leader Joe Benning said Vermont's opiate problem is, in fact, one of the reasons he supports the bill. Legislative analysts estimate that a tax on marijuana sales will generate as much as $20 million annually. And Benning says some of that money will be used to bolster drug prevention and treatment programs that aren't currently up to the task.
This bill, and no other piece of legislation in this building right now, this bill actually sets up a system to start addressing that problem. And if we don't pass it, Mr. President, that problem will only get worse.
There are a lot of reasons that lawmakers and Vermonters are lining up in favor of and against legalizing marijuana in the state, and we're going to cover some of them today. Joining me first is Matt Simon, the Marijuana Policy Project's New England political director. He's been lobbying for the legalization bill at the Vermont State House, and he was there yesterday to witness the debate and the historic vote. The Vermont Senate is just the second legislative body in the nation to vote to approve legalizing marijuana. The New Hampshire House previously voted in favor, but that bill never made it to the Senate floor. Matt Simon, let's take a few minutes to talk about what happened yesterday, and thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
So the debate lasted a couple of hours on the Senate floor. Were lawmakers pretty vocal about where they stood in advance of the vote?
Well, many of them were. The bill did make it through three committees before getting to the floor, so there was obviously a lot of public discussion already, but it was fascinating to see it play out fully on the Senate floor and see where some of the senators, we weren't sure where they stood, see what they had to say.
Fascinating why. You've been talking, I imagine, to everybody that you could pigeonhole in the lunchroom or in the hallways.
Well, we have, but it's really just been a bill that's gained momentum each week of the session. I think the first week of session, nobody thought it could pass the Senate. And then with each week of testimony, I think senators became more comfortable with the overall concept. And really, Senator Dick Sears, the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, was the key player in all of that. If he hadn't been convinced to support this, I don't think there's any way it would have passed on the Senate floor.
Because Dick Sears at the beginning of the session said he was opposed to the bill.
He did. He committed to having hearings in his committee, but there were a lot of people were very doubtful that he would end up supporting it. And after 3 weeks of testimony, he became convinced. That has led me to believe that just about anybody can be convinced if they really take time to study the ins and outs of this issue.
Well, 13 senators weren't convinced.
Well, that's true. Actually, one of the 13 voted against the bill because she said it didn't go far enough for her and didn't allow home cultivation.
So I think you're talking about Rebecca Balint. She said she wanted to see the ability for people to grow their own marijuana at home included in the bill, and because that was not in the bill, she voted against it.
Correct.
Okay, so 12 senators, though, who weren't convinced that this is the right course of action for Vermont. So it was still a mm-hmm. close vote, even though you say, you know, anybody can be convinced with enough time and effort. Certainly not everybody in the Vermont State Senate.
Yeah, no question. I think we're up against about 70 years of government propaganda telling us that marijuana is as harmful as heroin and cocaine, and we're undergoing a transition. It's going to take time, but as we saw from the poll released earlier this week, you know, there are certain demographics that still oppose this. Over 65 voters and Republicans still don't have majority support for this, but all of the other demographics show that support is strong and I believe increasing. So it's going to take time. The bill is a go slow, cautious approach. Marijuana wouldn't even become legal for adults until January of 2018. So I think the way the bill is constructed reflects that desire to go very slowly in what is for sure a substantial shift in policy for Vermont.
Matt Simon, it sounded like if the bill could pass anywhere, it was going to be in the Vermont Senate. How comfortable do you feel about this debate now moving to the House?
Well, we went through the process in the Senate, and as I said, I think the bill gained momentum each week. So if the House committees are willing to do what the Senate committees did and schedule the same testimony, I have to believe that they're going to become convinced that this bill should pass this year and that it does put Vermont on a responsible path forward.
Well, this legislation now moving over to the House gives lawmakers and people in Vermont another chance to share their thoughts and their concerns. Listeners, if you have a position that you'd like us to know about on marijuana legalization, or if you have questions, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. There is, of course, still very strong opposition to this idea, and I'd like to now welcome Dr. Jill Reinhart to the program. She's a pediatrician from Burlington who opposes legalizing marijuana, as do several Vermont and national professional associations of physicians. Dr. Reinhart, it's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So what's your reaction to the Senate vote yesterday?
I'm disappointed, though I'm not necessarily surprised. There has certainly been a lot of pressure put on our senators about this topic, and I've had the privilege of testifying and talking to people and trying to understand where people are coming from. I think senators are worried about representing their constituency, and but I'm not so sure that everybody understands the real ramifications of legalizing versus decriminalization, which actually happened in 2013.
Does that, though, not give enough credit to constituents and to voters who seem to be paying attention to this issue pretty carefully?
Yeah, I do. But I think when I'm talking to people, they're like, oh, our Vermont legal system is full of substance abuse treatment people instead of criminals. And I get that's a very sympathetic and compassionate place to be coming from on this issue. But that's not the case in Vermont. In fact, since...
At least in the case of marijuana.
In marijuana, right. And since decriminalizing it in 2013, we have gone from 1,100 folks in prison related to, or with charges related to marijuana possession, down to just 59 in 2015. So in my estimation, decriminalization has really been effective in that way.
So it sounds like decriminalization to you seems like an okay thing that Vermont, and it's already happened, so there's not a lot of point in arguing against that. But
exactly.
Why are you opposed to legalization?
My biggest priority is for children and families in our state, and legalization gives this message that it's safe to use marijuana. We know that the commercialization of marijuana depends on users and depends on young people using as future users. And so despite what we say or may not say about the black market shifting away, for children, that market is always going to be a black market. And they have access to it in many different ways. And, you know, I'm a pediatrician. I spend every day talking with teens and understanding what the pressures are that they go through day to day. And we understand that there are a few things that go into helping our adolescents make good choices. And when it comes to drugs, access and availability is a big number one. The perception of harm, so the idea that marijuana is not as harmful as, say, cigarettes or alcohol is what they're believing, which isn't true, by the way. And then also this general cultural acceptance, and those three things increase the use of marijuana and the choice to use for young people. Legalizing, I'm afraid, and I will give a stamp of approval, like that's okay to use marijuana, and it's not able to protect our youth.
Matt Simon, how do you address the issues of the potential for increased use among teens and the difficulties in telling teens this is dangerous? I mean, we aren't talking about legalizing this for young people.
Yeah, absolutely not. I think there's a very important distinction to be made there, and that one of the goals of this policy is to regulate marijuana and try to, A, keep it away from teens. Now, we all know that's never going to be entirely possible, but what the bill does is all of the tax revenue that would be generated would be applied to substance abuse, education, prevention, treatment, and enforcement. So for people who are concerned about the opiate problem and people who are concerned about young people, I mean, they're not getting the message today. When I listen to Dr. Reinhart and other doctors testify, they say that kids today believe marijuana is safe. Today they believe it's harmless. So I hear that too, and it frustrates me. I know marijuana isn't harmless. I think the harms are objectively less severe than alcohol and tobacco, and I think there's ample evidence to support that. Tobacco kills about 500,000 Americans each year, according to the CDC. Alcohol kills 6 Americans each day just from its from alcohol poisoning, according to the CDC, and that's not counting the tens of thousands of Americans who die from the long-term effects of alcohol, and not to mention on the roads. So marijuana is not harmless. There are harms. It's particularly risky for adolescents, and that is a message that we think can be transmitted much more successfully in a regulated environment. The people who are selling marijuana today aren't doing the kinds of education that Dr. Reinhart would like to see. If we put this in a retail store, we're able to do direct-to-consumer education and also fund the kinds of educational and ad campaigns that would actually make an impact potentially on the way young people see marijuana.
Dr. Reinhart, is that compelling to you?
Well, I know that it's wonderful how our youth aren't using tobacco as much as they used to, but that took billions and billions of dollars for that to occur, and we're still fighting that struggle against tobacco addiction.
So wouldn't $20 million a year help?
So I don't think that's nearly enough. Our system is broken already. We don't have enough access to substance abuse treatment programs for our youth, for our young adults right now.
And that money not being enough, but adding more to the system isn't what you think the right
exactly.
solution is.
So opening the doors, and I do believe that legalizing will increase our use and therefore increase the use of marijuana and the increase addiction and abuse disorders.
Let me ask you why you believe that. The Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration released data at the end of 2015 that showed that marijuana use among teens nationally did not increase in 2014, and this is despite a lot of discussions about legalization and the legalization of marijuana in a couple of different states. It did go up a percentage point in Colorado. Colorado was already a state, though, with high rates of teen use of marijuana. Vermont also has a high rate, as you pointed out. Why do you think that legalizing it would make teen use go up?
It will be more available, just like alcohol now is more available. It would be in households. Currently, our youth get alcohol primarily from a friend or someone else who's buying it for them. Just because it's in a regulated market doesn't mean that they're not going to have access to it.
It doesn't sound like they have a hard time getting access to marijuana now.
Well, it's interesting. They do, but it is easier to access alcohol than it is marijuana, and the students report that at 69% of high school students say that it's much easier to get alcohol than marijuana.
Matt Simon?
I wish I had those numbers in front of me. They're within a few percentage points of the availability
Seven.
Of marijuana and alcohol are very close to being the same in Vermont today.
Dr. Reinhart says she has them in front of her 7%.
7%, but it's easier to obtain alcohol, but it's not harder.
Yeah, I think for high school seniors, it was 1% point difference. Marijuana is very widely available today in Vermont.
But won't
it be
more widely available, Matt, if it's legal? I mean, it will be in people's homes. It will be something that is accessible legally to adults and therefore potentially accessible to more teenagers.
Yeah, it's accessible to teenagers today, just as it was when I was in high school. And the real goal here has to be to convince adolescents not to use marijuana, at least until they're adults. And that's the goal of the new policy.
And I would say there's a difference, I don't know how old you are, but between the marijuana from your high school to the marijuana that we have now, in that it has been genetically modified to be 6 to 10 times more potent.
It has not been genetically modified, doctor. I'd ask you to cite your source on that. I think it's Patrick Kennedy, and he's wrong.
And I have from psychiatry, I don't know what else genetically modified means other than it's a plant and it gets modified to change the potency.
It has been bred to increase the THC. The average THC content is higher today.
Is higher. That's true. That's what I need. So that's the biggest point. It's different today, and it is more potent, and therefore it has the potential to do more harm than good. I do think, though, in terms of looking for sources of funding for substance abuse treatment, there are plenty of legal substances now that could be taxed that are harmful to people, such as sugary beverages or alcohol or fossil fuels.
Alcohol is taxed.
Right.
But fossil fuels are taxed.
They could be taxed more. That could be different. So there are other sources that don't require upfront money as well to start the process of regulating and commercializing marijuana. I'm really worried about what we've seen in Colorado in the unanticipated health consequences, such as increased drug-related school suspension. So between 2000, 2008 and 2009 in Colorado, it's gone up 40% to 2013 and 14 after legalizing. There are these unintended consequences that are happening that that aren't thought out. And, you know, 70 hours of testimony that our senators have heard is great. I'm glad they're listening. But it's nothing compared to waiting 2 years or 3 years till we really have more data on what this means for our families and children in Vermont.
We're talking today about the legalization of marijuana. We're listening to Matt Simon, the Marijuana Policy Project's New England political director, and Dr. Jill Reinhardt, a pediatrician from Burlington who opposes legalizing marijuana. And we're getting a lot of comments, a lot of thoughts from our listeners. Sean says, opponents of legalization seem to ignore the fact that a large percentage of Vermonters already use the plant, and no laws will change this fact. The reality is that humankind has sought and found ways to alter their consciousness since the beginning of time, and sticking one's head in the sand will not change this. It seems to me that the most sensible approach to dealing with marijuana use is to move it out of the shadows and carefully regulate it. Lynn in Thetford has a different point of view. She says the gold standard of tourism is that prosperous families will vacation in Vermont, bringing their preteen or teenage children. They eat at restaurants, they stay at hotels, they shop, they ski. If such a family is the least bit worried about drugs and their children, legalization will make Vermont suddenly less attractive as a destination. I can see the ad campaign now, she says. Ski and shop at tax-free, drug-free New Hampshire. And Mariah says, how will I protect my children from other families that may smoke it in their home? Or what about packaging or products that are appealing to kids? It's hard enough as it is trying to raise my kids to make good choices in the face of so much popular media that glorifies and normalizes drug and alcohol use. We're going to take more of your calls and emails coming up. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're looking at the Vermont Senate vote yesterday to legalize recreational marijuana, and we're going to move on to what happens next, what still needs to be resolved before this could possibly become law. We're talking with Matt Simon, the Marijuana Policy Project's New England political director, and Dr. Jill Reinhardt, a pediatrician from Burlington, who joined several Vermont and national professional organizations of physicians in opposing legalizing marijuana. And we're hearing from many of you as well. If you have a question about what you've been hearing, call 1-800-639-2211 or share your position on legal weed. Post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. And let's go to Ben, who's calling in from Lindenville. Hi, Ben. Go ahead.
Hi. I was just wanting to say that I think it's awesome that we're having this discussion. It's really cool to hear everyone's opinions. And I would agree that with the issues that people who are against it are saying, with it don't want to have kids and, you know, high drivers on the roads, those are valiant points. But I think that I just wanted to bring up that the black market is so pervasive, and that having it illegal really hasn't changed. I don't think people who use it and people who want to get it will still get it no matter what. When I was in high school, it was, at least in my experience, easier to get marijuana than alcohol or tobacco, because you could get marijuana in school, during school, from kids in the bathroom, versus alcohol, you had to kind of figure out a way to get it because it was all at stores and stuff. So, I don't know.
Yeah, Ben, I appreciate your take. Thanks for calling in and letting us know. Let's go to Ryan, who's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Ryan. Your thoughts.
Hi. My name is Ryan Krishnick. I work at a teen center in Bristol, and I'm not going to speak necessarily to the if it should or shouldn't be legal. I think the state will figure that out and vote on it. But I want to talk about just the prevalence of it, and that I work here, and you know, we always keep an eye out for substances coming in and out of the teen center. And consistently, when we do find kids, which isn't that often, what we're finding is kids with marijuana. Cigarettes are legal. Alcohol is legal, but we very rarely, if ever, really find those. It's marijuana that we're finding all the time, and I think it's very interesting that the illegal drug is the most pervasive drug within use of kids, and when we ask them about it, when we talk to them about it, they say it's totally safe. I'm hearing about it in music. I'm seeing it on social media, and there's not really a voice to combat that. So I think the cultural aesthetic of youth right now is that this is a safe drug, and it's easy to use, and you know, whatever the statistics might be, I would argue, like the last caller, that it is actually easier to get because you put it in your pocket and you take it to school, and that's where a lot of the kids are getting it. They're getting it at school. They don't have to go to the market. They don't have to go anywhere else.
So, Ryan, for you, does that make you support or oppose legalization? Because it could go either way.
I would say if we can tax it and put that money towards educating our youth, educating police officers on, you know, talking and engaging in their communities, we can get the community involved with youth to talk to them that this isn't necessarily a safe drug, and we can kind of take the clandestine kind of rebel nature away from it. I think that's going to take strides towards dismantling the narrative that it's safe and cool to do right now.
Ryan, thanks for calling in. I appreciate your take as well. We got a note from BHA who says, should we change the speed limit on I-89 to 75 miles per hour because a majority of people, based on observation, want to drive that speed? Legalizing marijuana because a slight majority of people polled want it doesn't mean it should be done. Matt Simon, you've heard a couple of voices here. What are you thinking in response to what people are saying?
Well, I think what I'm hearing is, I think, broad agreement that marijuana is already very widely available. And the RAND Corporation's report said that there are about 80,000 Vermonters using marijuana each month, and they're spending about $175 million each year. I think Governor Shumlin and the majority of the Senate want there to be fewer illicit drug dealers in Vermont, knowing that illicit drug dealers are people who will sell to underage consumers and who many times will introduce them to substances that are far more dangerous than marijuana. So I really appreciate the last caller's comment. And I think that applying this money towards substance abuse prevention, education, and treatment is a really smart way to go about legalization.
We also got a note from Kim, though, who says, after Governor Shumlin's broadcast of Vermont's heroin and other drug problems drew national attention, it seems completely ridiculous for Vermont to even consider legalizing an illegal drug. It simply makes no logical sense. Dr. Reinhardt, weigh in here on what you're hearing as well.
Yeah, I agree with the caller who called in about how readily available marijuana is as well. And in Vermont, children less than 18 seek substance abuse treatment for marijuana more than alcohol and other illicit drugs together. So even with our cry for help on our opiate addiction problem, marijuana addiction is a real problem in our state already. And we do need funds to combat that. I'm not discrediting that. But I don't think it's true leadership to just do what the popular vote is. What true leadership is listening to the people and then bringing about evidence and having a thorough discussion and really understanding what the evidence suggests and how we can go through this and in a thoughtful way for what's best for everybody. And if we don't believe the evidence, if for example, if Mr. Simon doesn't believe the data that's coming out of the HIDA report, then why don't we wait until the evidence is trustworthy? And we have the right data to move forward.
But we already have substances that are legal for adults that we know are dangerous. Mm-hmm. Tobacco, alcohol. I mean, as you've talked about, alcohol is a huge problem.
It's a very low bar to compare marijuana to tobacco and alcohol. And drug-to-drug comparisons is not where I think we should go.
No, really, and I don't want to do drug-to-drug comparisons, yeah. But I mean, there are substances that are legal for adults to use, mm-hmm. that are illegal for teenagers to use. And in the case of tobacco, for example, as you've pointed out, there's been a huge educational effort to teach teenagers about the dangers of tobacco, and it's been successful.
Yeah.
I mean, not completely successful, but
it
successful.
Yeah.
So is this about, trying to keep all dangerous substances out of the hands of teenagers, in which case we're not doing a very good job with alcohol or marijuana,
right.
Or, you know, where do you fall then on this idea of legalization versus education and risk?
I think ultimately we all are responsible. I am as a pediatrician, I am as a parent of teenagers, of educating our children on the harms of substances. I'm here to speak for those kids, you know, that 22% that have used in the last month. I'm not giving up on them yet. And I think by legalizing it, we're giving up on them. We're saying, you know, it's okay. It's illegal, but it's okay. And we know that it's going to decrease your motivation, has the potential to decrease your IQ points, even greater than lead exposure. But I don't want to give up on them.
I think that's a remarkable claim.
What?
the reduction in IQ points. I'm very familiar with the study that purports to show an 8-point reduction in IQ.
For children and adolescents who are heavy users of marijuana that start in teens, the drop is comparable to the decrease
you're talking
in
about one study, and the data of that study was criticized by other researchers
and again,
who published
you can
in the same journal.
The data.
And just last month, there was another study published that looked at a twin cohort in which one twin had been a marijuana consumer and the other hadn't, and they found no evidence of an IQ drop. So that,
but
that,
Matt Simon and Dr. Reinhart, you both agree.
Accepted.
But you both agree that marijuana use. You've both said on this program this hour that marijuana use among teenagers is a risky behavior and it shouldn't be allowed. You both agree on that. So
absolutely.
I mean, and there are a lot of statistics, and it's worth knowing them and knowing which ones are accurate and are not. But I think you both agree on this idea that teenagers should not be smoking marijuana or using marijuana in other substances. Am I right on that? Both of you agree
absolutely.
On that?
Yeah. I just want to make sure we're using research that is, you know, that has been reproduced and that is widely accepted by the scientific community.
So how do you combat, though, as we did with all this money from our tobacco industry, how do you combat the commercialization of these products to children? We've seen it happen, and it has a lot to do with edible products, obviously,
which are not included in this bill.
But I have heard from Matt and others that edibles are part of what they would like to have happen. Is that true?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah,
so when we have
the
edibles, exactly, and those market products that are edibles are gummy bears and cookies and granola bars and things that our children have access to. Not that we're not going to raise our kids to make good decisions. We have them make good decisions and not to go underneath the cabinet for the chemicals either. But that's a real healthcare impact that this doesn't really consider. In Colorado, in the first 4 months that it was allowed to be retail, 9 kids were treated at Children's Hospital for ingestions, whereas 9 over the whole course of a year had been treated before. So it's
absolutely
not that you and I don't want to protect our kids. It's the fact that having this more available is going to have health care consequences.
Yeah, no question. So that was one of the early hiccups in Colorado that they wish they could do over, is do a better job with packaging and regulation of edibles from day one. They went back to the drawing board and they tightened up those restrictions quite a bit. Interestingly, you may not know this, in Washington from day one, they've learned from those lessons. In Colorado, everything has had to be no more than 10 milligrams per serving size, each serving individually wrapped, and they don't allow any products that they believe would appeal to children. Every product in Washington has to be approved by the state regulator, and if they think it appeals to kids, they won't approve it. So there are no lollipops, no gummy bears. You wind up with a very different looking product, and I haven't seen the newspaper headlines from Washington.
Interesting. When I was in Seattle in the fall, I was on the SeaTac train, and there's a public health announcement there to remind parents of the dangers of secondhand smoke from marijuana use. And again, that's another place that we see an impact. It's not just on the actual use of teens, but also on our parenting. We've spent a lot of money, thankfully, on early childhood education and programs to support parenting where they're paying attention to their children and having meaningful interactions. And I would argue that families with parents who are under the effects of a substance that causes them to have short attention span and low motivation are not the kinds of parents that we want to necessarily be exposing our next generation to either. So there are many ramifications of legalizing that go beyond just whether a teen is using or not.
Matt Simon, I want to bring another question to you and another perspective here that's come in from Dr. Thomas Mosley in Newport, who says, why do you suppose that the people best positioned to have knowledge about this issue oppose legalization at this time? The majority of law enforcement, including the commander of the Vermont State Police, 6 medical societies in the state who treat children and adolescents, and school counselors. Shouldn't this be a measure taken on the basis of best knowledge, not a beauty contest?
Well, I would absolutely disagree with the notion that the opponents have the best knowledge. In my experience, most of them are quoting straight out of a federal law enforcement agency's propaganda report called the Rocky Mountain High Intensity Drug Trafficking Association. Yes, some of the data in that report's accurate, but it's all presented in a very misleading fashion. And that's what we hear quoted by virtually all of the opponents of this bill. There's a lot of good independent research out there. I've been researching this subject for 20 years. I just find it hard to believe that those individuals are the most credible, when we also have the current attorney general, 2 previous state attorneys general, the sheriff of Windham County, it's very difficult for members of law enforcement to cross that blue line and say, you know what, this policy we've been enforcing has been a mistake. But we have seen leaders of law enforcement do that. I think we'll see more, and I think that's part of why this is happening. The legislators have heard from these very credible people. Senator Sears heard from his own primary care physician and mentioned that on the Senate floor, that his own personal doctor of 25 years supports this, and he was surprised by that.
Let's get some other perspectives in here. Amos is waiting on the line from Jamaica. Hi, Amos. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I was at the hearing yesterday on the Senate floor, and it became increasingly clear to me, which was a little surprising, that this legalization bill has nothing to do with civil liberties of Vermonters. It actually has to do with two things. It has to do with taking a multi-million dollar industry, which is now done on the black market, and controlling it. It's been hard for them to put their finger on the marijuana industry because it is sort of a nebulous black market, but there's a lot of money going down. And I know the Marijuana Policy Project has spent a lot of money to make sure that all this money goes to a very few people. My concern with this bill is that it is taking money directly out of communities and giving it to corporations, and at the same time reducing personal freedoms by providing a significant amount of money, up to $25 million, for enforcing this.
Amos, thanks for your thoughts. I want to just add on to them as well from a couple of listeners who wrote in to say they're not entirely happy with what's happening. David says, the same class of sober, well-meaning, responsible, informed souls that spent the past two centuries destroying their own habitat are going to suddenly have the wisdom to regulate the use and distribution of a beloved plant that is grown virtually everywhere and has been in wide use for thousands of years. These people can't balance a budget, can't keep our roads and bridges in decent repair, and can't keep kids from destroying themselves with poor food choices and alcohol. Nonetheless, they feel obligated to perpetuate some form of control over cannabis. How about employing the Vermont ethos of less is more by simply removing the disastrous prohibition and allowing nature to follow its course? And we got a note from Stephanie in White River Junction. Stephanie writes, I'm all for ending prohibition. However, I am against a bill that does not include the right to responsibly grow for your own personal consumption and instead licenses the right to a limited number of people at a high price. Allowing home growing and more small commercial grows would bring a bigger boost throughout the economy on many more levels than the current bill does. Imagine the revenue if all home growers had to purchase a permit and renew it annually like hunting and fishing licenses. While the bill includes language to study what allowing home grows would look like, it doesn't go far enough, and it's just another form of prohibition. Matt Simon, what about the fact that this commercializes something more than allows for people to use it?
Well, I'd like to point out, first of all, that we did advocate for allowing limited home cultivation in the bill. We don't think that's led to substantial problems anywhere else. And with regard to, I mean, I've been blamed for basically everything anybody that doesn't, any piece of this bill that people don't like. The bill was written by legislators who are trying to take a cautious, phased-in approach. It is not the bill that I would write if it was up to me, but it is a very big upgrade, in my opinion, over the status quo, and it takes Vermont down what I believe is a responsible path. We think this industry can be responsibly regulated, and we think that over time, we'll get there.
That's Matt Simon. He's the Marijuana Policy Project's New England political director. Thanks for your time, Matt.
Thank you.
Dr. Jill Reinhart, before we let you go, if this does move forward, do you think there are ways to mitigate the impacts on teenagers if marijuana is legalized?
I think keep talking about it with our youth and making sure that they understand the risks of the substance and trusting your frontline providers of who are in there in the trenches. Substance abuse counselors, teachers, police, and physicians who all deal with this on a day-to-day basis.
So are you scared about this, or do you think there's a way to make it, you know, as sort of smooth as possible if it does become legal?
I am scared of it, but I will be there to help make it as smooth as possible if we need to.
Dr. Jill Reinhart is a pediatrician from Burlington. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us as well today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Coming up, do you know what happens exactly when you go to the polls in the presidential primary next week? We'll fill you in on the hows and whys of primary voting in Vermont next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. We're just a few days away now from Super Tuesday voting. Vermonters have a chance to weigh in on who they'd like to see as president. Of course, right now you'll be voting in one party's primary to choose the party nominee. So we're going to spend a couple of moments in this show on how exactly the voting process works, because it's different from the primary process for state candidates. Jim Condos is Vermont's Secretary of State, and he's here now to give us the details. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Jane. Well, I'm pleased to be here.
Good. Well, we're excited to have you. Okay, so I'm going to ask you to walk me through the process here. So we go to our polling places on Tuesday. Vermont has an open primary system, so nobody's registered with a party and going to a particular party's area to vote. So I walk into the school gym or the town hall or wherever I'm supposed to vote in my town, and I walk up to the poll workers and...
You give your name, and the poll worker will check you off the list and ask you which ballot you would like, Republican or a Democratic presidential ballot.
And I don't have to show my ID.
You don't have to show your ID. This is just for the presidential primary, not for the town meeting portion. That's a different ballot.
Right. So this is so just now about the primary, although in many cases you'll be picking up many pieces of paper because you'll also, if your town does Australian balloting, you'll also be voting on things for
your
town.
This is actually the only election, the presidential primary, where you actually have to declare which party's ballot you want. Because as you described it, we are an open primary. You're not registered by party in Vermont. And this is the only time that you actually have to do that. And the clerk, the poll worker will actually record which one you take. And that it goes back to many years ago. It was the discussions between the two parties and the state as to how they wanted us to have a closed primary with registration, and they and Vermont being an independent breed, we did not want to have that. So this was the compromise.
Okay, so that poll worker or the clerk will mark down which ballot you've chosen. What happens to that list?
That list is a public record, and anybody can ask for that list at any time.
So I could go and say, I want to see who Jim Condos, which party Jim Condos voted in, which party's
primary.
Generally,
you don't pick the person, but usually they'll get a disc for each of the states or whatever.
And that doesn't go to the parties, though? It doesn't go to...
They will ask for it.
And they will get it?
Yes.
So the parties get to see those lists then. This is not how it works for the parties in the primary process for state candidates.
Where in August.
You pick up all of the ballots... Three major parties, you pick them all up, and then you vote on one, you put that in the slot, and then you move the others aside, you don't vote in that.
Correct.
So why
you
the
will
discrepancy?
Discard. This is just, again, it's the agreement that was long before I became secretary. This was the agreement that was put in place, and they decided to just focus on the presidential primary and not on any of the other primaries. The other primaries... Because Vermonters are an independent breed, and they generally don't vote, you know, by party for all their candidates, and we've seen that over and over again, just even in the last 5 and 10 years, it's just the way it works. You will, like you said, you will get three ballots, you will vote on one, and then the other two get discarded.
So this is really about what the parties wanted way back when we decided this, because they want to be able to have those lists of who voted in the presidential primary.
Well, let's think about what a primary is. It's the party nomination process. The state actually manages that process for them, but it is a party nominating process.
Why is the state involved at all in that case?
That's a good question. That would take us back to 1917 or 1918, and my former state archivist, Greg Sanford, who probably knows more about that than anybody, but it goes back to 1917, 1918. We used to have caucus conventions prior to that, and the state just decided that it was getting too big and that it should go to a primary vote, and that's when it happened. And then things after that, they change over time.
When we did a show at Dartmouth College before the New Hampshire primary, Dartmouth professor Linda Fowler brought in a copy of what the ballots look like in New Hampshire for the primary. And in New Hampshire, and remember, there are often more candidates on a ballot than are actually either still active or are major candidates that we're hearing a lot of press for. So you may have a longer list of names. You will have a longer list of names on your ballot than just, for example, two candidates in the Democratic primary. And in New Hampshire, your ballot may not look the same as my ballot because the names are scrambled. It's not just alphabetical. They're randomly assigned an order on the page, and some people get a different one than others. How does it work in Vermont?
Vermont state law requires us to put the names on the ballot by alphabetical.
So everybody's ballot's going to look the same.
Everybody's ballot will look the same for the presidential primary.
Okay, and what happens once the votes are all in terms of who counts them and how they're counted?
Okay, first of all, the counting is done at the local level. The town clerk will then take that information back to their office because often they're at a different site, and then they will upload that information into our election night reporting system, which then a day or two later they will come back and actually certify those results. They'll check their results, make sure that on election night the results that we have on our website will only be unofficial results. We don't count write-ins for that. It's just the tabulation of the candidates that are listed. You get a pretty good feel for it, but that's what it works out to be.
So they're counted at the county level, and then they are sent to the Secretary of State. So they're not sent
Correct.
To the parties. It is your office that actually deals
Correct.
With this, and they're certified at the town level, but then sort of certified by the Secretary of State.
The town clerk
office.
Will certify it. Then it becomes. Then we will take it from there, and actually, 7 days later, the following Tuesday, we will have a canvass of the major parties to actually certify the overall results.
Now, some towns have ballots that are counted manually, and some have voting tabulation machines, but all of the ballots look the same regardless of what your town
yes,
is?
Yes, all ballots. A couple years ago, we requested that the state legislature change the requirements for the ballots so that they're all the same. That way, we are able to use tabulating machines if we had to have a recount.
For you, is the primary night, I mean, it's also town meeting day, but is it a kind of a fun day for you, or is it like a slog because it's just all of this work you have to do?
It's a culmination of a lot of work, and leading up to it, my elections team has been working right out straight. They've been working late hours getting ready for it, and by election day, we'll have somebody in the office at 6 o'clock, and we probably won't leave the office until 11 that night. But we'll be ready to go home that night, and we're ready to get some sleep.
And if people want to keep track of the results, they can, of course, listen to VPR, and we hope they will, but they can also look at your website.
Yes, we have the election night reporting on our website, and just go to the elections page, and we'll have a banner that you can click on that says election night results.
That's Secretary of State for Vermont, Jim Kondos. Thank you so much for filling us in on what's going to happen on primary day.
You're quite welcome.
And finally today, we'll read some of your comments to recent programs. Vermont Edition producer Rick Singeri is here. Take it away, Rick.
Sure thing, Jane. This week, we released the VPR poll. It gives us a snapshot of public opinion of candidates for top offices, and it also shows where people stand on policy questions like energy, education, and marijuana.
We dove into poll results on the show, and here are some of your comments. The poll shows that 51% of Vermonters generally support the state's efforts towards consolidating school districts. But Mike in Middlebury disagreed with our guest's characterization of the law that's meant to encourage consolidation.
He writes, if Act 46 is intended to promote sustainability, why do the carrots include short-term incentives that will go away after schools have come to rely on them? And why do schools get to keep their small school grants if they consolidate? If this is sustainable, it's only on the backs of other Vermonters that aren't undergoing the accelerated merger and are funding these subsidies.
And on the question of how Vermont decides where to put wind and solar energy projects, there's a correlation that shows the people who are most informed about the process like it the least. Walter writes, though, the conclusion that's being drawn from the poll is that the closer people follow solar siting, the less they want a site in their neighborhood. I would suggest that this conclusion is somewhat skewed. Doesn't it make more sense that the less people want a site in their neighborhood, the closer they stay informed?
And here's Mike. He says, I was always and still am a huge supporter of renewable projects, but when they are proposed without the support and approval of the local community, it's not right. These projects are being sited at the benefit of the developer and investors and not at the interest of the communities. This is all about big money, not about doing what's right for Vermont's energy production for its own use.
On polling in general, Bob in Burlington is not a fan. He writes, I'm disappointed to see that VPR has gotten into the polling business. Polls may be helpful to people betting on elections or working for a candidate, but they have little value for voters trying to decide which candidate to support. More time should be spent on fact-checking and challenging candidates' statements and less on entertaining us with, quote, news about the off-the-cuff opinions of random people.
Yesterday, we dove into the question of whether or not Vermont should divest state pension funds from fossil fuel companies. It's a position that the state treasurer says would undermine her office's fiduciary responsibility.
And Chris in South Burlington says, if anyone thinks the transition to cleaner energy is going to happen without the ExxonMobils, Chevrons, and other major oil companies, they don't understand American politics or Washington, D.C., given Governor Shumlin's awful fiscal record, including burning up $150 million of tax dollars on the health care nonsense. I would trust Treasurer Beth Pierce on this much more than Shumlin.
But Jack posts, our previous divestment actions have all put us on the right side of history. Let's ensure that we are on the right side of history once again.
Well, we always love hearing from you. Keep your comments coming to vermontedition@vpr.net or post them on our Facebook page. Rick, thanks very much.
Sure thing, Jane.
All right, lawmakers are getting ready to take their town meeting day break. It's traditionally the halfway point in the session. In the coming weeks, how will the legislature deal with the legalization of marijuana, the siting of renewable energy projects, and a new tax on independent doctors and dentists? Tomorrow on this show, House Speaker Shap Smith joins us to talk about his priorities for the second half of the session. And you can send a question for him to vermontedition@vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.